Welcome to Think Like an Owner, a show exploring how the most ambitious CEOs grow great companies. I'm your host, Alex Bridgman. Each week, I dive into the strategies and tactics that build transformative businesses with the operators doing it firsthand. You can learn more about the guests and the companies they are building by visiting us at tlaopodcast.com. There, you will also find our weekly newsletter that further analyzes how companies are finding success today. Lastly, if you enjoy Think Like an Owner, please share this podcast with a peer and leave us a review. Well, this was a great episode for our second in the launch series with Alex Tinant and Nikita Sunilkumar on starting up your search. We went through the different time periods of a search, so 12 to 3 months prior till right before, then soon after the search. Had a lot of great insights all throughout, but really good episode overall.
Yeah, you know, Chris, Alex, I'm so jazzed about this series and this episode. And so, you know, we started talking about thesis research. For the second episode, we wanted to really get into the tactics of starting up a search. And this continues to be something that's a source of anxiety for entrepreneurs. And so we asked Nikita and Alex to just get really tactical. And I think my reaction from listening to it is, you know, these are great tactical examples and tactical bits of guidance for getting going, getting that first series, getting that first set of owner calls set up. And I hope people are really going to take something away from it.
Yeah, Aaron, I agree. I thought it was great. I thought Alex and Nikita had really, really valuable insights. But, you know, it's funny, I kind of had some flashbacks to searching myself, and just a reminder of how hard that is, how much anxiety there was at that moment, and how important it was to have support from investors, but also from my family, from other searchers. And just, it was a throwback to saying it really matters how you get started, how you set yourself up, how you partner with people. And so I guess going into this for me, the highlight for the listeners to consider for me would be, you know, first, searching is hard. And so you need a good support network. But second, I forgot about it. So it's really hard when you're doing it, but that all fades when you get to be CEO and you get to build a business. So I appreciate them doing it, and I'm excited to hear it.
Thank you both for doing this second episode of our launch series on search startup. I'd love to just start with a quick intro from each of you, and then we can jump into starting up a search and kind of a timeline of tasks and whatnot. But Nikita, do you want to start us off?
Sure. Yeah. Hi, I'm Nikita Sunilkumar. I am a former engineer and consultant. I came to search kind of in the typical way, found out about it in my MBA program at Kellogg. I searched in 2019 and acquired a business in 2020 in the geriatric primary care space. It was a traditional search, and I was backed by a lot of great investors, including Trilogy here in Washington State. I operated the business for 22 months and had an exit in December of 2021. Kind of an unexpected opportunity, but great outcome. And then I transitioned to working with Trilogy on the investing side. I currently work on our recruiting efforts and connecting with prospective searchers who are thinking about launching their own searches.
Yeah. And my name is Alex Tinant. I'm a current searcher. I'm about 8-9 months into the search. I guess a couple parameters of my search. I'm doing it solo. I did have an MBA in my background, although I didn't start the search directly after the MBA. I also don't have an investor background. I have only ever been an operator before, and I'm looking at almost purely software businesses. Again, this just ties into my background here. And I think something important to add here too is that, you know, I try to be judicious about who I take advice from, and I myself have not yet acquired a company, and that company has not yet gone on to do great things. Nikita has actually done that. So always good to keep in mind with some of my comments here.
The only thing I would add on timing and sort of search launch is there's a whole world of ways to go about it. And so I'll try to cover sort of examples of things I've seen at least and sort of options along the way. There's really no one size fits all kind of approach to launching a search. There are some models that have worked for people and sort of defined approaches that people have taken, but this really is a choose your own journey.
Yeah, certainly. And we've broken up the search startup discussion into a number of sections, kind of based on a timeline before and after search. So first section is around kind of 12 to 3 months prior to searching. What are some activities you should be working on? Things to think about, questions to ask. Next section is, you know, the month before the search, what did that look like? The month after, and then 6 months into the search, what does that look like for you? So maybe starting with the 12 to 3 months prior search, Nikita, you had a lot of really good thoughts around questions to ask and things to think about in this phase where you're kind of beginning to plan out what your search could look like and some key questions around there. Love to hear your thoughts there.
Yeah, absolutely. So I think the really common approach that folks take is that they hear about one of the models of search, right? You may hear about a self-funded search, or you maybe read an article about the traditional model or something like that as a starting point. And that's great. I think we, when we talk to searchers now, we really recommend that they talk to, you know, as many folks as they can in that 12-month mark, sort of starting that year before you actually go out and fundraise. So that's talking to current searchers, talking to CEOs, talking to investors. And it's not unusual that searchers have met, you know, 25 plus other searchers in that process, or, you know, a dozen or more investors. That network definitely helps as you get further along in the process. So, you know, it's good to invest upfront. The other thing you want to do is look at other models other than the ones that you've already been introduced to, right? Even if you're thinking you're going to go do a traditional search, maybe, you know, look into what does a self-funded search entail, because it really then brings to relief, you know, the pluses and minuses of each approach and what you really want to prioritize. Some of those elements, right, are just, you know, how much risk are you wanting to take? What size of business are you looking to buy? What do you want to gain from having an investor network and investor relationships? What type of, you know, personal considerations do you want to, you know, put into this? Are you trying to do something that's geographically limited? Are you open to traveling anywhere to find a business? Do you want a partner? And, you know, definitely having conversations at that point with your family as well about what the next 5 to 7 years of your life might look like is really important. So these are all things for that 12-month kind of mark of starting the journey. At that point, too, I will just say something that we're seeing a lot more of is folks coming to search from different approaches, different backgrounds. Typically, I think we're used to seeing MBA, you know, graduates coming to the search model with preparation from their MBA programs or their clubs or anything like that. But there's also now folks who are coming later in their career who are learning about search. Maybe they're alums of these MBA programs that produce a lot of searchers currently. Or the other option is folks who worked for search portfolio companies. So you may have been a chief of staff at a search-backed company or taken on an executive role. And that's a great sort of training ground to think about launching your own search. And yeah, I won't say that, you know, like I said, there's no one right answer for anyone, but there's a ton of options. And the more people you talk to, the more perspectives you're going to get.
What are some ways in which somebody could figure out if they would enjoy being a CEO, like after the search concludes and hopefully they find a business and that becomes their life for the next few years? What are some ways that you've seen that are effective at figuring out if they would enjoy that part?
I think I'll give my perspective and then turn it over to Alex. I think it's really taking opportunities along the way in your career to take ownership and really exercise that element of leading a team, really, and you know, taking a team on a journey through growing something or building something, even if that's on a smaller scale in a larger, you know, corporate setting. So for me, for example, this was, you know, I had a really operationally heavy job when I was an engineer. It did give me a lot of freedom and flexibility to go out and define, you know, what my day-to-day looked like in order to accomplish some goal, even though that wasn't sort of an independent entrepreneurial venture. And it brought me in contact with a lot of different people and just building a team, kind of motivating a team to go get something done. That was really exciting to me and it really inspired me. I think other folks can get that element a few different ways, certainly through their jobs. Maybe you did something at school that gave you that kind of element of leadership and team building. Maybe it was something that was, you know, volunteer work or your own, you know, side hustle or whatever it may be. There's tons of different ways. I think working for interning with searchers is a great option, or interning at a search-backed company, like I said, or working for one is another option. But there's definitely multiple approaches.
I think to Nikita's point, those are all really great comments. Two things I would add here hopefully these aren't too much of a trope, but the first being answering the question, why should people follow you? Are there some examples from your background where you've been able to demonstrate that? Another way to repackage that being, have you gone through this journey of being a doer, becoming a leader, and then a leader of leaders? Both of those could come from anywhere, to Nikita's point. For example, the military or a nonprofit background. There's no reason for an MBA or some set path to be in there.
And then, so if someone's decided that search is in fact something that they want to do, and they've done enough research and got to know enough people that the being a CEO is something they think they could enjoy and potentially be good at, is there work around industry research or trying to think through the story to tell the owners using your past experience? Is there something in there that's helpful to do in that 12 to 3 months prior to searching?
Yeah, I think it does partially depend on if you're doing an industry focused search versus what I'd call a broad-based search. Either scenario, you need to have your story together. I've said this before, but you're really a glorified inside sales rep. Why should these owners or founders talk to you? It really has to be apparent in that first email, and definitely in the first conversation, why this could even be a conversation worth continuing. So what has to come across is that you're not just some random interloper, that they could see you taking the reins of this company, which they have built for, in some cases, 30 years or more, and have worked with those employees or customers for 30 years. So your fit for that company and where it would go in the future, it has to be, that story has to be very buttoned up.
I'll definitely echo that. I think, you know, there's definitely different approaches you can take, as we discussed. I'll give sort of a perspective here that's more informed by my experience and the work we do at Trilogy. We really do believe in the industry-focused search. I know, Alex, you have another episode that talks about that more tactically. But, you know, what it really does is it allows you to align all of the elements of your background and your interests with that of your investors and the potential sellers that you're going to encounter, and in the future, even the teams that you're going to work with and the employees. So, you know, you're really starting with a perspective of what's my background, where are my interests, where are my strengths? Then you're tying that to where are the industries where I can add value and I can really make a difference. You're bringing that forward to the conversations you have with your investors when you're fundraising to really make the case for why they should partner with you. And then finally, when you get in front of the seller, as Alex said, you know, you're talking to them as a credible member of that industry, or, you know, someone who could be a credible member of that industry and really take their business further and do more, you know, than someone who's just sort of walking in off the street. All of those things really form a really nice narrative, and they are all sort of accretive, you know, steps that you take one after the other. And it comes back around, right? It doesn't end when you acquire the business. As a CEO who's interacting with your board and potentially continuing to work with your seller, and then, you know, continuing to engage with employees, competitors, potential buyers, all of those things start lining up where you're saying, hey, I'm building upon prior experience, prior knowledge, and prior awareness to really do right by this business, as opposed to saying, I've bought something where I really just don't have any idea what I'm walking into, and then having to kind of learn all that at the same time that you're taking the reins of a probably a very complicated business that you're also trying to learn the ins and outs of. So yeah, very much a proponent of the industry-focused search, and something that we do encourage people to spend a lot of time on. And, you know, there's a lot more resources now on how to weave all of those pieces into your materials when you're launching a search, specifically your PPM, which is the private placement memorandum that you circulate to your investors. So, and you know, we share a lot of those resources with people that we work with as well.
Yeah, certainly. Maybe we can start moving to that kind of 1 month prior to search phase and raising your capital and drafting your PPM. Do you want to talk about kind of cap table and investor selection and how a searcher should go about thinking through that as they're close to launching their search?
Yeah, I can start here. If you're working on a traditional search, most cap tables have a pretty standard structure in that you'll have a couple of lead investors. These are folks that take, 15%+ of an allocation on a cap table. They'll probably be, one or more of them will be your first call when you're looking at deals, and they typically will have more staff and time and resources to dedicate to support you in the search. Then there's a great set of institutional investors in the search space who have industry expertise, have great networks, have great sort of pattern recognition in specific industries. So you definitely want to find out, who has worked in the spaces that you're interested in, understand how you can cultivate that relationship as it gets closer to acquisition time. Maybe you want to build a board from some of these investors and ask them to partner with you in that way. And then there's a long tail of individual investors and smaller investors in the space that are new to the space. Also great to kind of build a group of those folks who bring very specific, maybe operational expertise, or maybe they have connections to particular sectors of the economy where you want to learn more. All of that can be really helpful. For example, I do a lot of work with healthcare searchers just because, there's a lot of little complexities that you just wouldn't know about unless you are working day in and day out in that space. So I'm happy to share that knowledge. And there's a lot of great folks who have that domain knowledge in particular pockets. What you're looking for is a lot of diversity of thought as well. You want folks who will give you good, clear feedback and be able to engage with you when you're looking at deals and, tell you honestly what they think. And then ideally you want folks who will take the call when you really need them to and say, hey, yeah, I'm here to help. Maybe it's 10 minutes, 15 minutes out of their schedule, but it can be really, really impactful to you as a searcher and a CEO when you're under the gun trying to get something done. So that's something that I would also consider as important. But that's roughly the structure that I've seen. There's also other variations on that, of course. But
to add on to Nikita's points here, a couple of factors you could consider. One is just the number of investors you want to have involved. There's pros and cons of having a smaller or larger number of people on your cap table. For example, if you have a lot of people on board, that's just a broader network you can pull resources from, get referrals from, have just different perspectives or experiences. At the same time, that's going to take a lot of cat herding when it comes to deal time or making the bigger decisions. If you have to get 15, 20, I've even heard investors to align on something. Flip side of that, if you have a smaller group of investors, yes, it is much easier to get to a clear decision faster. But at the same time, maybe you don't have someone that has experience in an area you're looking at. Or this could apply on the larger perspective as well. But are you going to have enough funds to do potentially a larger deal if you have only a couple smaller investors on there? Other variables to consider, things like, what is your mix of funds versus currently operating CEOs versus former searchers who are now turned investors? They also have different perspectives and how they look at things. I myself have a mix between more funds that have experience investing in software search deals specifically, and then former searchers turned investors. And I think the best way to help answer this and think of some other variables are just talking to searchers or searchers that went on to become CEOs, just saying, hey, who did you like in your cap table? Who would you call for random questions that could sound dumb? And that way you can triangulate around who you want to build your own team from. For example, in my case, I think I talked to 10 or so former searchers, and I drew the Venn diagram between their comments, and it really just overlapped on essentially my current cap table. So that was, it was really helpful. Last thing I'll squeeze in here too, another parameter that would be useful was just making sure your investor group is aligned on your search strategy. And by that, I mean things like an industry focus search, what types of companies you're looking at, where what this could look like if you don't have alignment. Say you're looking at software deals. Investors who are used to more business services are going to say, no way am I paying that amount of money. They're just not used to it. Or on the flip side, the software investors, when you're looking at a services business, they could say, there's just not enough growth potential for me here. It's just not what I'm used to. Same on the sourcing strategy. There's some investors who say, hey, brokers are great. They have really deep networks and you should include them in the platform. Personally, in my group, for example, they'd say the exact opposite. Avoid brokers. You're signing up to have your deal be on an auction. Avoid at all costs. So if you have a mix of those people talking, you know, if you have one on your left shoulder and one on your right shoulder, that's going to be a conflicting experience in your search.
Alex, you mentioned that you would call current searchers and current CEOs and ask them about certain investors. Did you find that to be the most helpful way to vet and understand which investors you might want to partner with most?
Yes. I think this point around the triangulating between searchers who did the, call it the closest thing you want to do. So, you know, we spoke earlier around what are some of the basic variables of your search, like geography, industry driven, solo versus partnered. I would just try to talk to searchers who've done it as close to the thing you're planning to do and see what their advice is. It's going to be really tough to beat that. One other thing I'll mention too, I would try to get people who have searched more recently, ideally, just because it is a really dynamic field, if you could call it that. And hell, even 5-6 years ago, things were pretty different in terms of the market, absolutely, tooling, you name it. There's, within any given time frame, there's a lot of changes in what a search looks like.
You know, I like Alex's approach of triangulating, right? Some folks may have just naturally closer relationships with certain people, and that's great. But what you're really looking to hear are those examples of, like, how did you interact with this person? What did that look like? What were the circumstances and the context of it? That can be really, really helpful. And it's very clear when we're talking to new searchers who's done that and who hasn't, just because, you know, you start to see all of the ways in which that investor searcher relationship can evolve.
And so turning to drafting a PPM, you've mentioned before a couple components are fairly standard, but we'd love to hear more about constructing a PPM and what specific sections maybe searchers should pay the most attention to or think the most about.
I will take this again in terms of just the quick things that we look at. You know, there's certainly some sections that are fairly boilerplate and they're intended for investors that are not familiar with the search model. So, you know, it's pretty common to include kind of a primer on what search is and how it works and all that. That's all pretty standard. The things we look for are really the searcher's background, their biography effectively and their resume, their industry thesis work. And then finally, we look for kind of the surrounding detail on how they intend to approach their search. And this could be anything from, you know, very, very specifically, I intend to spend this much time looking at broker deals, or I intend to focus on this geography, or I intend to have 100 interns. I don't know, I'm being facetious. But really the parts of the PPM that will tell us what is this person actually going to go do once they launch their search is really helpful. Again, going back to an earlier point, you want to have alignment between all of those three things, and you want to show that narrative of, hey, this is my background. It's going to inform which industries I'm searching in. This is the reason I like this industry, and this is sort of the context around why I think it's a good opportunity. And then finally, this is how I intend to approach the search to make my chances of acquiring something in this space, you know, the highest possible chance. So all of those things have components that will inform each other, and we're looking for those threads to kind of connect. Sometimes it's clear people will come to us from a particular background, but they want to search in something completely different. And that's fine. But I think you kind of want to acknowledge that and speak to why you think you can bridge that gap and what specifically you're going to do to build credibility amongst other investors and sellers and so on.
Yes, a few things that I'll add on to Nikita's comments here. Geography and any kind of geography focus, it's a basic one, but you have to have it figured out. This goes back to talking with your spouse or partner around what could work. There's a lot of companies where you have to be in person, and it's just a part of the culture. And the founders will often just ask you, hey, so this is going great. Are you going to move here? And here could be any number of places that you're probably not expecting. So good to have that figured out. Another broad focus on, hey, would I do services, healthcare, tech-enabled services, software businesses, even just understanding if you would do all of those, would you focus on anyone? That will also, frankly, just help you a lot as well in figuring out where you want to focus your search. And that should be clear in the PPM. This last one, I think it goes into the, partly ties into how you want to build your cap table, but would you look at more, call it growthy companies versus filling in white space, where that is the key bet of what you're looking for? Your investors are probably going to have different philosophies on which of those they prefer. And then it'll probably come down to the idiosyncrasies of whatever company you're talking to or working with, but just having a perspective there is useful.
Can you dive into the idea of white space a little bit more? What do you mean by that?
Yes. And I think this was an example, maybe from my own PPM. I had a couple industries in there, and one of them was software for tugboats, workboats, barges. So you can imagine probably quite low industry growth there if you're looking at a software tool for those operators. But at the same time, probably a really large white space in terms of end users shifting from pen and paper to software, or some generic tool to a more specific software tool. And the bet is essentially around, can you get to a double-digit market share? This compares to what I was calling more growthy company or growth industry, where the industry overall is growing quickly. So, I don't know, 12% yearly and up. So that's more of a bet on your customer base itself is growing. So you could be selling to a certain type of healthcare vertical, and there's new roofs going up 20% yearly, for one example I'm thinking of here. It's really a pretty different bet than the first example, and just good to have thoughts on either of those.
Yeah, what I'll also piggyback off of this. It's great when a searcher has done their homework on knowing kind of what are the portfolio companies that a search firm has or search investor has already invested in, right? It's something you can also understand from having those searcher calls and CEO calls. You can get a sense for you know, who investors are by looking at those things and then coming to the table sort of for that first conversation with an idea already in mind of, these are the folks I want to work with and these are the reasons why, can really make that conversation pretty meaningful. And, you know, of course, it doesn't hurt to ask and build that knowledge, but as much of that as you can get done beforehand is great, because when you have the PPM and you put it in front of someone, you want to know that, you know, that's a valuable conversation for you and for them. So that's always a good sign that someone has done the prep work. The last piece of a PPM that I forgot to mention are obviously the terms, right? So there's some key terms in here that you want to be aware of and have put some thought into. Certainly how much you're planning to raise, what you're planning to use that search capital for, what does your budget look like is important. You're obviously talking about, you know, how does the sort of structure around the equity compensation work. You really want to understand that and have taken time to you know, do whatever models you need to, so you get the gist of that. And then anything that's sort of significantly off market, I would say you really want to have thought about why you're including it and sort of what the ultimate goal of that element is. So it's hard. It's very hard to talk about those things because they all change, right? The market is not a defined thing that stays fixed. It's kind of a fluid piece of the industry. So again, a lot of conversations are necessary to get a handle on that. And, you know, there's some specific legal pieces of the PPM that you'll work with a lawyer to put together who ultimately represents the fund that you're going to pull together. So there's a few folks that do a lot of this work in the industry. So you want to make sure you're connecting with them early and understanding all of that.
Would it be helpful to outline what terms or market terms are today? Or is that something you'd rather researchers just reach out to you directly than you just tell them over the phone or something?
So when we're working with searchers at Trilogy, we track what we're seeing as, for example, what is an average budget? What is an average salary for a searcher? Things like that. And we do have that data internally, and it's always evolving, of course, but we can share that information for folks who are interested.
The equity share that you and your partner, if you're doing a search, that's just one of the terms that they're probably one of the less flexible terms. And this is because they're investors, and these are really important. This is a really important variable in both their outcomes and your outcomes here. So you should have a really good reason why you're proposing, call it an off-market structure. And hey, you might have one. If you've been, if you're older, perhaps you've done a search, you just have a lot more experience under your belt, you could have a good claim to having a better outcome here, simply because you can say, I've done it before. But that being the one thing where that's a firmer variable in the PPM.
This is all assuming, folks are doing a traditional search and they're raising a search fund specifically, and then they're going to go out and actually acquire something. In situations where people have already found a deal and they already have something under LOI and they're coming to us more opportunistically, that can be different, of course, and those terms are negotiated more on a case-by-case basis. But even in those situations, it helps to know kind of what is market and what does a standard structure look like, so that you have a context on, these are the two or three things that I really want to change or negotiate or push back on or whatever it may be.
So switching over to 1 month after search, so first 30 days after raising your capital, starting to search. Alex, I know you've thought a lot about what that initial couple phases look like in terms of your technology cadence, kind of daily set of activities and whatnot. Would love to hear your thoughts on the tools you've been using and kind of the cadence you've set up for yourself within that first kind of month or so.
This is a really good question and still feels fresh and top of mind for me, even though I'm 8-9 months removed from it. But something that I did that I found useful was writing what I called a search process playbook. And this is probably just because I'm too structured and write playbooks for everything. But this really helped me because writing it down, I really think that writing is thinking, and it forced me to figure out what precisely I'm going to be doing on a daily, weekly basis. And you might uncover things where you're thinking, I actually don't know how I'm going to, what do I do if they don't answer my email sequence at all? And it is a really high quality person. Perhaps that's something that didn't come to mind previously. Other things to think about, your, call it the search tech stack. I would not spend much time on this. This is something where it's a really established set of tools. For example, you're going to have a CRM, something to send your outreach, some basic email quality or reputation score checks, things like that. But for example, I've just been using HubSpot and Google Sheets and LinkedIn Premium. You can get pretty far using the large established tools. So this is another thing where, hey, just ask some searchers what they liked and play around a bit in the first month, but no need to over-engineer this. This is not where you will get gains from your process. Setting up a weekly cadence was pretty useful here too. I've heard both sides of the spectrum of, in my case, you could call it a batch or more structured approach where, hey, I'm searching for companies within an industry on Monday. I'm clarifying what exactly I'm going to say to them on Tuesday. I'm sending the batch emails to them on Wednesday and figuring out the next industry on Thursday. That type of weekly cadence. That's what I mean by that. You could just be doing this in a more fluid way throughout the week. Pros and cons of both, but good to test it, see what it feels like. To the point of testing, I think testing out your outreach and systems in a low stakes way is pretty important. And by that, I mean, I'm almost certain you're going to send an email that says, "Dear first name" on it. And you're going to look ridiculous if that goes to the highest quality person in the hottest industry that you're interested in. So send some of your first batch of emails to your friends, or send it to yourself even from some alternate accounts, and just see what it looks like. I think this is really important and a great step that you should be doing. Another way to de-risk this a bit is, and this is just advice I had gotten, you can assign a ranking of a particular company for when you want to reach out to them. You could call it something like a fit quality score. And so this might look like maybe the company is, it could be too small, it could be too big even. Just your mutual fit there isn't as good as you might think it could be. And then you try to sequence it where you contact those weaker fit companies first. This is to, again, make sure you're not blowing up when you're in a more high stakes scenario, but it also helps you learn too. I've had plenty of people, founders, where, yeah, they're looking for more of a VC fundraise and I don't really want to sell, but they got a new connection when they're ready and I learned a little bit about the industry, something that I didn't know before. So that can be really useful. Last thing I'll say here, just setting up your basic funnel metrics, and this is just for your outreach, response rate, meeting rate, things like that. Just having the tooling set up. And this is arguably, I think this is what you're trying to solve for with your search tech stack. So if you can do this in a simple way, that's great. Just make sure you can check and understand where you stand on your general search KPIs.
Yeah, those are fantastic. I think the couple small ones I would add are, you know, thinking about positioning yourself to sellers. You'll put together a website as part of this initial setup as well. So we've had some conversations recently about, you know, how do you present the persona that you really want to sellers via the website? Do you put, you know, links into your emails to direct them to a particular page, for example, maybe that talks about their industry? We had this conversation with some of our searchers who are veterans, you know, include a picture of yourself in uniform, because that's something that might connect with folks and certainly, you know, builds a lot of credibility and you know, signals a great, great background. I think the other part that we've been thinking about is, and we offer to do this with all of our searchers, is really looking at the language of your emails, because, you know, I think we're all used to getting these sort of form emails that are almost like fake cheerful and sort of like quirky, but kind of weirdly quirky and somewhat annoying. So, you know, you don't want to be on that end either, but you also don't want to sound like, you know, a robot wrote your email. So there is this sweet spot in the middle of saying, how much personalization do you want to include? I think we polled some of our searchers, and I think the ideal kind of number of items to personalize in an email might be 2 or 3. If you're personalizing more than that, you're potentially spending too much time on each email. Or I like Alex's approach of maybe you're segmenting your lists and saying there's a handful of folks that are really, really critical or really, really important in this industry that I want to spend a lot more time personalizing outreach to. but everyone else, maybe they just get sort of a generic thing with a couple of elements that are personalized to them. It, within the first month, you may not know all of this yet, and that's totally fine. I think we try to connect with searchers in that early phase and look, you know, work on one thing at a time. Maybe one time we'll talk about looking at emails and just redlining and giving some feedback. Maybe another time we talk about, you know, the stats, like how are things going? What's your funnel look like? What are response rates? I really like the reflection item too, because it's easy to kind of get too deep on any one of these things and lose a lot of time. And what you want to make sure you're doing is giving yourself opportunities to come back to baseline and just try something else if it's not working. And then the last piece is, and you know, we'll talk about this, I'm sure, later, is the team. Are you going to have interns? Are you going to have help on any of these particular things? People have different approaches and that's fine, but I would not feel sort of obligated to go build a giant team right off the bat on day one, because that will take a lot of your time and a lot of energy to get right. And so maybe adding folks as you need them and really refining that as you go is the approach you want to take. There are folks who have, you know, really big intern teams, and that's fine. And if that's sort of the way you're used to working, that's great. But I wouldn't feel like it's a necessity.
For interns, I intentionally waited until about month three into the search. And that was because I myself didn't know what was working and where I needed help. I was just trying to figure out, hey, where is the bottleneck in my process, and then put resources at the bottleneck, essentially. In my case, the bottleneck was jumping between industries in an effective way. So it's a hard thing to assign interns to, because it's a pretty involved item, versus maybe your bottleneck is, I just got to look up the LinkedIn domain of this account faster. So it's certainly an easier bottleneck to have and more amenable to intern work.
Nikita, you mentioned being an investor and redlining and reviewing emails that searchers are sending out. In what other ways should a searcher be thinking about how they describe themselves when talking to not just the potential sellers or CEOs, but experts in the industry or, you know, friends of theirs who are asking about their search? Like, what are some ways that are helpful to think about when describing the search and like the process and what you're working on?
I'll answer this personally as a searcher. You know, I don't know that there's sort of a consensus investor view on it necessarily, but, you know, it's really helpful to think like a member of that industry, right? What are the trends that are really defining that space? What are the things that are going to be top of mind for those sellers? And so when you're talking to, you know, I say this because I found my business because someone in my network introduced me to the seller of my business. It was kind of it was not a traditional sort of outbound thing. And I had had a thesis around sort of geriatric care and all of that, and had made that generally known to people in my network. And ultimately that was very helpful when I met the seller of my business. So I definitely believe in sort of the power of having a clear idea of what you're looking for and why, or you might say, hey, I'm really interested in this particular thesis or this particular thing that's emerging in the economy or this particular pocket, and making that generally known and saying, I'm looking for businesses in this space or opportunities in this space. Or if you're really early on, maybe it's just, I want to learn more about this space, and kind of refining that as you go, because as you get to know more, you'll have that sense of, this is really where those critical points are in the industry that is on everybody's minds. And then when you put that into an email to a seller to say, you know, hey, I saw that you were featured in this magazine because you figured out this very cool thing about your industry or whatever it is that you're using to personalize, like that can be super powerful because it's coming from someone who understands them and their what they're doing every day, as opposed to sort of a generic, you know, message that I'm sure they get every day from private equity firms saying, you know, I'm so and so and I would love to talk about acquiring your business, right? So that would be the approach I would take. I think there's others, certainly, especially if you're looking at maybe the handful of companies that are in a particular part of the country that you know well or that you've lived in, that can be another factor to personalize. Maybe it's folks that are in an alumni network of a school that you're kind of affiliated with, or, you know, there's all these different elements of personalization that you can go, you know, figure out. And this is a great project for interns, right? Go look up this list of 500 people, look up one sort of unique thing about the top 200 or something like that. Can be a good way to approach it.
I think Nikita is very right here. I think in the first three sentences of your outreach email, it must be apparent. You either have some connection to the industry or you've done your research enough where you can see that, okay, this person is intelligent and is an actual human being for one, and isn't just a complete tourist or outsider. I cannot overstate how many emails the founders and CEOs get. It's often once a week, and it's the worst type of emails. And to be fair, it's mostly from PE funds or just investment brokers. And I've seen some of these, and they're just atrocious. It's things like, "Hey, we have the best capital. Would you like our quality capital?" And there's nothing there at all that demonstrates knowledge of the company, the industry, and the founders are used to seeing those and deleting them immediately, obviously. So you have to, within the first couple seconds, make it clear you are not the same as those people, because it is truly very common. Especially, I'd argue, the more quality the company or the larger the company, they're getting this even more. So the stakes are even higher for the types of companies you would be most interested in.
Yeah, you talked earlier about if it's not genuine, like, people are going to notice, and it's going to come through as more financy, private equity, and not quite this genuine connection that you're trying to create with an owner.
I'll just say the part that was interesting is, so I did receive these messages when I was working at the company that I acquired. So, you know, as much as you can put yourself in the headspace of a seller and kind of understand what they're looking for and how, sort of on the plus side, it gives you a lot of insights. On the negative side, kind of makes it clear how busy they are, and you're really trying to thread a very, very sort of tiny needle in terms of getting in front of them when they have the headspace to be able to kind of give you the 30 seconds of their time to read that email and actually respond. So, you know, maybe this is another reason to spend time talking to CEOs and talking to business owners before you start your search, is really putting yourself in that headspace and understanding what it is you're trying to accomplish from the other person's perspective.
Moving into 6 months down the road. So first 6 months are over, you're kind of working 6 months out from now into your search. Alex, you mentioned earlier that this is kind of the point where you should hopefully be hitting kind of a groove and kind of a steady state within your search. What does that start to look like and feel like? And how do you know if you're getting into that groove or not?
I can speak for myself here. I'd say it's around month six. And I guess qualitatively, it was things like the process just feels automatic. I don't really have to think about what I'm doing on a weekly basis. When I'm speaking to a founder, there is no script needed. I know what I'm going to say and what's important there. On a quantitative side, your metrics have stabilized in many cases. So you should be at some steady state. For example, up until month six, my, you know, reply rate percentage was still improving. So that was great. And just seeing those stabilize, that, hey, this is where you'll be if you continue your current approach. I think something that you might not see even at the end of 6 months is that some of those earlier conversations might not yet be coming around or being fruitful. And what I mean by that is, hey, maybe you spoke to some people, some founders pretty early on, and they've just been noodling on it for the past 6 months, or they heard their friend just sold for a ton of money, or even, hey, they just, they had some catalyst in their life where, hey, maybe I should see what Alex's pitch is all about here. And that often takes longer than 6 months. So there still are some benefits to be gained that come later. And especially when you're building some kind of relationship, there's a lot of searchers where they, you know, there's a relationship building process over a year or so. And it's hard. Well, from a seller perspective, it sure feels better when you've been talking to someone for over a year, you've built some kind of relationship. That's a good situation to be in, and you might not be reaping those benefits yet.
We do find that at the 6 month mark, most searchers have run through kind of their initial thesis ideas or niches that they put in their PPM, right? That they probably yielded enough to run a few campaigns, two or three campaigns. And one thing that I did with some searchers recently was think about, you know, how do you make that ideation process repeatable? If you have a team by then, maybe you have a couple interns that you can bring in, all sit together and say, how do we map out the universe of all the things that really fit under the thesis that we started with? How do we get creative about building lists and refining those lists and sort of putting the finer kind of level of detail into that work? Initially, it may have just been, oh, well, I went to Grotta and I found the 300 companies and I just sent emails. That's fine. But at some point you start saying, okay, well, now I'm really narrowing down on these particular niches within this particular pocket. And now I'm starting to think about, well, who are the industry experts here? Who are the river guides? Who are the associations that really are meaningful and have a lot of voice in this space? So that kind of stuff, if you've thought about your search as something that evolves, right? That's the natural evolution at the 6 month mark, I would say, is really putting that second layer of detail and understanding into the industry's niches that you're looking at. Sometimes it's tempting to say, well, nothing here is working. I'm just going to throw it all out the window and then go look at something completely different in a new part of the industry or a new part of the economy that I don't know anything about. It's not to say you can't do it, but, you know, ideally you started with a big enough sort of world of options that you can filter down and narrow down or look at adjacencies where a lot of the knowledge that you've built up for the first 6 months is still helpful. You're just taking a slightly different lens at it. And that can still be powerful. You know, you may be saying, I'll give you a healthcare example here. You might say, well, I've worked in this part of healthcare, but now I'm pivoting to this part of healthcare. Hey, seller ABC, you know, this is the experience I have or knowledge I have from this industry. I would love to learn how it applies to your industry or to your subsector or whatever it is, just to start over in terms of building that industry knowledge. If you have a chance to do that, even before you start your search of thinking about how will I pivot, how will I move to adjacent pockets in a systematic way, that can be super powerful. And it will, you know, it'll save you time, especially when you're, you know, in your 2 year search, every week and every month can feel really important. And if you don't want to lose that time, having that process predefined is great.
I think Nikita's right that you will probably have exhausted your initial ideas in the first 6 months. I've tried to think of this as the way to get to the next industry or thesis. You could think of it as shifting horizontally or shifting vertically. So what I mean by that, maybe you're looking at practice management software for senior living. You could shift to practice management software for optometry or some other healthcare or medical vertical. The other side of this is, hey, maybe it's not practice management software, but what other tools do senior living operators need? Maybe they need some kind of revenue cycle management tool, a resident engagement tool. You could just go through the org chart, essentially. You know, what would marketing need? What would sales need? What would ops need? So that's what I mean by horizontally across industries, but same product, or vertically, same industry, different product.
Alex, you had a couple comments too around KPIs to focus on during search and certain benchmarks to hit that could tell you, you know, quantitatively, like, are you on the right track? Is your search progressing the right way? You've mentioned a couple throughout just our conversation here, but what numbers do you track and what benchmarks do you compare those against to measure your progress?
Yes, I definitely agree. The whole search process, it's a binary outcome. You found one or you didn't. And I had seen some data. It was three or four different searchers, entire funnels for 2 years. And just listing how many people did they reach out to, how many conversations did they have, so forth. And it's funny because every single one of them end in acquiring one company. And every single one of them had, it was something like three, maybe five LOIs. So that bottom of the funnel, it's all almost the exact same. It's the further up that varies a lot. And we keep talking about this because it's a pretty big distinction, but it's this idea of an industry-led versus search versus what I would call maybe disparagingly a spray and pray, where you're going more high volume or more broker-led. In my case, for example, I'm only sending 50, maybe 60 new outreach per week. So pretty low volume. And that ends up being, again, approximately six new calls per week. And one, at least the plan is to have at least one in-person meeting per month scheduled. It's, again, these are all pretty low numbers, but you can still make it work effectively. And I've seen both sides of it to that first example about the very different methods to achieve the same outcomes. That's something to add. I think that the total number of LOIs, at least from what I've seen, maybe four or five over the course of 2 years. So again, to that earlier point around the top of funnel leading to the same bottom of funnel results.
The number I've heard is actually even lower, but that might have been executed was like, you know, 1 to 3 LOIs in a 2 year process. So yeah, it's not far off. Yeah, I will say from the sort of investor side, I can't speak for everyone, obviously, but the funnel is important in the context of the searcher's approach, their own kind of progress from day one on to month six or whatever it is. And then, you know, just, I think we're looking for sort of really crazy outliers. If you're saying you're contacting 20,000 companies in a couple months, it's like, okay, well, we probably will have a chat about, you know, how are you filtering? What industry is this? What's sort of going on here, you know, to make the funnel look like that. And then the really kind of meaningful conversations happen when we start talking with searchers about targets, about specific conversations. And this is a great time to include your investors when you have sort of that, you've had the initial seller call and you think there's a promising kind of approach here. There's either something sort of about the company or the industry that's interesting to you that you want to run past the investor group. Great time to call your lead investors and say, hey, can you give me quick feedback on this? And then say, how do you, you know, share with us how you're planning to approach that next call? Or maybe we talk about what are the three questions you want to get answers to before the next call or on the next call. Those are pretty critical junctures where the, you know, even 30 minutes or an hour with a seller can make a big difference in whether or not that deal has a future. So use your resources at that stage, and we're happy to give you, you know, everything that we can to help as well. One thing that I think searchers may hesitate, and I certainly did when I was a searcher, is asking for, you know, tactical help on putting together an LOI or asking the questions of anything you don't understand, you know, in the structure of that LOI, or which terms would you prioritize and why. You know, don't hesitate. Definitely ask all of those questions up front, because, you know, the better informed you are and the better sort of position you are to guide your seller through that process, the more likely it is that you'll be able to get through kind of all of the ups and downs of what might come next if you do get a signed LOI. So, you know, please don't, I'll sort of say this to everybody that we work with, and certainly other investors I'm sure would echo, don't hesitate to just ask those questions up front. It can save you a lot of heartache and effort on the back end, specifically like networking capital, for example. It trips everybody up, and it's fine if you just need someone to walk you through how to think about it in the context of a particular business. We're happy to do that.
We've also touched on hiring interns and other outside help during the search. I'd love to hear from each of you on utilizing interns, or I know some folks have used virtual assistants or other folks along the way to help in their search. Nikita, maybe starting with you, what do you talk to searchers about, and what kind of guidelines do you have for using interns that have been really helpful for folks?
Yeah, this again is going to be more informed from my personal experience. It really helped me to have interns that came in with a very specific goal in mind, as opposed to having sort of a general team of people that I then had to figure out how to deploy. I went out and said, okay, I need someone to do a lot of the sort of basic data cleanup and, you know, data entry stuff that's needed to build lists. So for that, I went out and went to Upwork and just got, you know, a $5 to $10 an hour sort of offshore person to just clean up a lot of things, get me emails, start working on building some personalized details about folks on the list, that kind of thing. The second part that was helpful to me was getting help on digging into industry research and getting sort of a unique perspective on that. And for that, undergrad interns that are later in their undergrad careers can be great, maybe pre-MBA. There's some different categories of folks there that can be really good. And, you know, having them go out and say, pull the sort of 10 headlines that are relevant to this industry, give me a summary of what I should know, that can be a great task. For the actual work on my sim and my model, I actually recruited folks from my MBA program, and that worked out great. Different programs have different structures where they might have class credit that they offer to people who work with searchers, or maybe you go to the club, the ETA clubs, and say, hey, can I get someone to work with me for a few weeks? It's super valuable experience for both parties. So ideally, you know, there's a lot of takers for this type of experience. For prospective searchers, you know, no better way to see what you're getting yourself into than just spending 6 weeks working with someone who's in the throes of it. And the other thing, the nice thing about that is there's sometimes a lot of folks who say, I can't do search because I don't have deal experience, or I don't feel comfortable modeling kind of all of these things around sort of, you know, an LBO model or whatever it is. Or they may say, like, I'm just not good with, you know, I feel like I can't get up to speed on this industry or whatever that is. You can address those things and sort of play to your strengths in your search. And it's vital that you do that, actually, because you're going to do that as a CEO for sure. So in your search, you know, maybe think about, okay, if you're not super comfortable with a model, right? You don't need to be. You will understand the dynamics of a business well enough to put together a model, I assure you, if you've spent that much time looking at it. And so an example I'll give is what I did was I built the model very simply to say, hey, these are the key drivers of top line revenue. And then this is the cost stack that really affects the bottom line. So here's the five things that I really want to be able to manipulate here to understand how this business operates. And then the person that came in to help me was an MBA student who had a prior private equity background, had worked in a PE firm, was really great around the modeling piece, wanted to see what it was like kind of on the search side, and came in for a couple weeks to really take what I had started and just put it in a really professional format and give me something that I could work with. And it was fantastic. And it was a, you know, super, super helpful step. And I'm very glad I didn't have a bunch of people, like I said, where I wouldn't have known what to give to which person to kind of fit their strengths, as opposed to saying, I know what I need, let me go find the person to fill that need specifically.
I think the Upwork folks are invaluable for data cleanup and list building. One tactic here that could be useful, and I just stole this idea from someone else, but you can do something like making a test, essentially. You have 100 companies in a spreadsheet. You already know the answer to their contact info, CEO, LinkedIn, whatever you want to call it. And you just delete those columns and send them to the Upwork platform and make a request for, hey, can I, you know, I'm going to hire five people and I need this information populated. And you'll get a lot of results back and you can check them all for accuracy, speed, billing, price. I mean, so in that way, you can find some really good people really quickly. And I've stuck with the same one or two Upwork resources the whole time. And they've been invaluable time savers. Many of them even have their own tools. You know, they'll have scrapers, they'll have LinkedIn Premium. So you can find that those people through the test indirectly. You know, if someone will say, yeah, I did these 1,000 companies in an hour and, you know, they didn't, and the results are good, they probably got a good scraper. You could just ask them, of course. On the intern side of things, it's been a mixed bag. Most other searchers I spoke to didn't get a ton of value out of, let's say, US-based undergrad or MBA interns. Everyone got value out of these Upwork virtual assistants or data prep individuals. So on the intern side of things, it's I think it might come down to what exactly you're hoping to utilize them for.
Any last closing thoughts on starting up a search from either of you for closing out the episode?
There's a lot of detail here, a lot of tactical things that we've talked about. I think one of the nice things about the search process is you see a little bit of everything. And I really cannot think of any other kind of career path or option that gives you such a wide exposure to so many sort of critical things that are necessary for any business. And I would say that about the search and about the operating phase for sure. So it's a lot, but you know, the year or two, you know, the year you spend preparing and the couple years you spend searching, no matter what happens, you're going to walk away with just some incredible skills that will be just super powerful no matter what happens after that.
I would say try to be as thoughtful as possible. If this is something you want to do, you're going to be spending at minimum 2 years of your life doing a search. Even more if you do a search and you acquire a company and it goes on to continue doing great things. Second, I'd say you should really talk to searchers and searcher CEOs. Nothing is a better substitute for their experiences and what they've gone through and seeing if this is something that would work for you. Last thing, more just a reminder that none of this is particularly glorious, both while searching or operating. You know, you're doing a search, especially if you're solo. Like I said, you're an inside sales rep. You don't have a team to talk to. You're all alone. And you get on a phone call with someone who's highly suspicious of your intentions. Same when you're operating. You're the CEO of a company. There's no VC-backed funding to fall back on, and you can stay in the red for forever. If that thing fails, the whole team fails along with it, and people are out of jobs. And it was really all on you that caused that. So stakes are high, and it's a tough but hopefully really rewarding experience.
Well, thank you both so much for participating in this episode of the Launch Series. So I really appreciate your time and insight into starting up a search. This was really fun.
Thank you for having us.
Thank you for listening. I hope you enjoyed today's episode of Think Like an Owner. If you enjoyed the show, please consider leaving us a review and telling a friend to help more folks find Think Like an Owner. I also want to thank our show's sponsors, Hood & Strong, Oberly Risk Strategies, and Ravix Group for supporting the podcast. For full episode transcripts and our weekly newsletter, please visit our website at tlaopodcast.com.